Just King Things bonusode. I'm Cameron. With me, as always, is Michael.
Ooh, I've mysteriously appeared here next to you.
Hey, you want to help me find my lucky quarter?
Sure thing. Why don't you take a look around my coin museum? My traveling coin museum. That's in a Winnebago.
It's not haunted.
No.
These all look haunted.
No, it's not haunted at all. Although I do have some scary stories about these coins.
You want to tell me maybe two of those and make them real long? You want to tell me two long stories?
Sure thing. And
are not in their heart inherently long. In fact, both of them might be the shortest, most conceptual stories ever written.
Oh, man.
But
yeah.
You just make their asses 45 full minutes each.
Mm hmm. Yeah, I can do that. I'm great at it.
Cool. Very good. Today we're talking about our guy, Mick Garris. Talking about his film, Quicksilver Highway. We got to get out in front of this one, Michael.
Mm-hmm.
This movie sucks. This movie, while watching it, I had the legitimate thought that this is the worst thing we have seen on the show.
Yeah.
Can you think of a thing that is worse?
Well, I didn't want to, like, yeah. I
Look, I
literally the other day someone asked me, what is the worst Stephen King adaptation? And you were there.
Yeah, I was there. I was there. And you
I passed on it because I did not want to sully your because you hadn't watched it yet, mm-hmm. I think. And I did not to put my thumb on the scale here.
I do like that you, like, soft-locked, like, an international interview we were doing to save me.
Yes.
Which I do appreciate. No, you tanked him. It was great.
I did.
It was you were trying so hard to be polite. I thought maybe you were being polite to not, like, shit-talk a movie on international radio.
Yeah.
Which also I thought was, like, a good idea. But maybe that probably... No, I think that is out by this time. But people, if you're on the Patreon, and you are on the Patreon, if you're hearing this, thank you so much for being on the Patreon. We'll have that linked in the newsletter for mm-hmm. this month. Yeah, but yeah, I love Mick Garris. You know, I will go to bat every day for the artistic merit of Mick Garris, the director. And Mick Garris, the screenwriter. I think he's very talented at it. I think this movie is exceedingly bad. And I can kind of intuit why that is.
Mm-hmm.
Because it wasn't supposed to be a movie. And Mick Garris, and I'll read from this later, in Master of Horror, his biography, which I would encourage people to check out. It's a fun read. In his biography, he basically is like, yeah, I didn't want to make, like, a serious movie. I just wanted to kind of do a thing and have fun. And anytime someone's like, I just wanted to have fun, I don't know if that makes for the best movies, personally. Just, like, let's do one for, you know, for funsies.
Yeah.
Throw one out there. That's not my favorite way of doing stuff. But, yeah, you tell me. What'd you get out of this thing? I don't know. What'd you think?
Okay, so at some point, someone, I don't know who, it might have been Mick Garris, it might have been someone else, was like, hey, what if we had our own Tales from the Crypt?
It was John McTiernan.
Who the hell is that?
Let me hit you with some stuff. I gotta give you an old IMDb. Mm-hmm. You might know John McTiernan from such movies as Die Hard. You might know him from such movies as Predator, as The Hunt for Red October.
What is he doing on those?
He's directing all of them.
So John McTiernan,
yeah,
wanted a Tales from the Crypt.
Yes, he wanted like a TV show. He and his wife, who was producing the thing, came to Mick Garris and was like, "Hey, will you basically do the pilot for this Tales from the Crypt we want to do?" And he said, "Sure." Fox was going to do it, right? Yeah,
yeah.
Here, let me read for you. It's on page 186 of Master of Horror. Because this is like kind of on the internet. I saw this maybe on the Wikipedia page. And reading the book actually gave me a little bit more context here. Garris says, John McTiernan and his wife at the time were producing. They asked me if I could come up with a series. They had ideas for a series of ghost stories. And I came up with this idea of Aaron Quicksilver finding weird stories around the country. The original title was Route 666, but at that time in particular in our popular cultural history, everyone was afraid of Satanism because of all these stories about actual Satanism and the like. So even the Fox Network, which was known for being more adventurous than the others, said, "No, no, no, you can't call it that." Quicksilver Highway as a title encompassed both the host character and the hoped-for range of settings. So yeah, John McTiernan, you know... imprisoned, bankrupted filmmaker.
Mm-hmm.
People might want to look up John McTiernan. He's had a pretty fucking weird life. So,
gonna look it up right now.
Oh, you're gonna look it up right now?
Mm-hmm. He's an American, retired, and imprisoned mm-hmm. filmmaker. Wikipedia yeah. usually doesn't begin like that. It doesn't actually begin like that. He pleaded guilty to perjury and lying to an FBI investigator in regard to hire. Okay. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Legally wiretap phone calls. Okay. Uh-huh.
Wiretapping. He was wiretapping a producer on his film.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, it's a weird shit. He like started pitching sequels to his movies while in prison. Yeah, he hasn't made a movie, I think, since Basic, maybe. Yes, looks like 2003, last movie. Yep.
Okay.
Anyway, he wanted to make like a silly ghost story series for Fox way before this. And you kind of wonder, what if that had gone a different way?
What if he was wiretapping Mick Garris?
No. It would have been the other way because he was the producer, so Mick Garris would have had to wiretap him.
Oh, okay.
But yeah, I mean, and also I don't want to downplay, so Donna Dubrow, who was the producer, right? Mick Garris says John McTiernan's wife, big quotation marks there, right? But Donna Dubrow, she also has said that he was wiretapping her and all kinds of stuff too. So he seemed to just kind of be doing that kind of thing around the world, and being a little bit of a control oriented fella, mm-hmm. it seems. But yeah, so he went to Mick Garris and was like, "Hey, will you like kind of help me get this thing off the ground? You know, maybe come up with the framework." And Mick Garris did. And then Fox was like, "Yeah, we don't want to do this. Are you interested in just making a movie?" And then they did.
Mm-hmm.
However, the initial episode, I guess, or the pilot was supposed to be, what, Chattery Teeth? Is that the name of the story? Chattering Teeth?
Chattery Teeth, yeah.
Which is a Stephen King short story we have read. We'll talk about it in a minute, I guess. And instead of, like, blowing that up to a full film or rewriting the whole thing or starting from scratch or shooting the whole thing into space with a cannon, which is maybe what I would have suggested doing, Mick Garris just... picked up another short story that he liked, maybe that was like in the hopper for being part of the series. The Body Politic by Clive Barker. And then just made it like the second half.
Mm-hmm.
And they are both stories told by Aaron Quicksilver in the thing. And so it's just like two episodes of a TV show you're watching inside of a movie you're watching.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the structure.
Mm-hmm.
So you tell me what you want to talk about here.
Okay. So we can start with let's start with both the frame stories because they're frame stories. They're thin. They have kind of the same conceit behind them, even though different things are happening. And they tell us about our buddy, Aaron Quicksilver.
Uh-huh.
Played by Christopher Lloyd.
I have something to read about this.
Okay.
Why don't we please describe Aaron Quicksilver for us, just visually. People are familiar with Christopher Lloyd. If you're not, he's Doc Brown from Back to the Future, probably his most famous role. And also a guy in The Pagemaster.
Yeah.
A librarian, maybe.
Unfortunately, I'm going to describe Christopher Lloyd in this film with an image first, because it is the only thing that I could think about while watching it. I'm going to send this to you, Cameron. It is uncanny to me. Do you know who that is, Cameron?
That is recently disgraced Jack Skellington singing. I'm blanking on his name.
Danny Elfman.
Danny Elfman, there we go. I kept wanting to say in my mind Mark Mothersbaugh, but Mark Mothersbaugh is the guy who did the soundtrack for this.
From
but
Devo.
Similar kind of, like, you know, tones, I guess I would say.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Recently disgraced Danny Elfman.
Yes. Danny Elfman, as he performed it, I think this was Coachella last year.
Mm-hmm.
So in this movie from 1997, Christopher Lloyd looks like Danny Elfman from this year.
He does.
It's like they have. Okay. So, like, set aside Danny Elfman. He's unimportant. It's just like, it's weird that they ended up here. Like, it's weird that this is the costume that they put together and this is what it looks like. They have Christopher Lloyd and a lot of, like, sort of 90s goth, black leather and pleather. In one, he's definitely wearing some kind of, like, cape or something in, like, the second story.
Yeah, he wearing a cape, wearing the big chunky leather collar.
Yes, with, like, yeah, like, chrome studs and stuff on it. Mm-hmm. And he's got makeup on. They've made him very, very pale. And he's got red hair, like, stringy red hair down to about his, like, eyebrows or so. And sort of dark spots around his eyes, right? So he looks a little spooky. And he's supposed to be in concept, right? If this is Tales from the Crypt, this guy is like the Crypt Keeper.
Except he's Aaron Quicksilver.
Yes. Who's just a guy who travels America telling people weird stories.
Yeah, yeah, just truly. Now, how would you describe this performance? Like, in terms of the way he embodies the character. Do you have any touch points here? You know, you had the visual touch points in Danny Elfman, but do you have any performance touchstones or references, you think?
Not exactly.
Because I've got one.
Okay.
I can tell. There is one.
There
but
is
I want to
one.
See if you can try to puzzle it out or if anything sticks out to you. Doing something here?
I was honestly so overwhelmed by the costuming and makeup that the performance did not stick with me.
Because, you know, Doc Brown is Marty. Blah,
yes,
blah, 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 blah.
Right.
You know, it's a very particular performance. And it's so particular that you see, or maybe this is just, you know, our generation. I don't know if this is everyone. But for me, I see Christopher Lloyd. And he is Doc Brown, right? It's such a strong character that's lodged in my mind that it's hard for me to, like, uncouple him from that, you know? I don't know if that's the same for you, but when he opened his mouth and he wasn't saying, oh, it's your parents, Marty. Oh, it's your kids. When he wasn't doing that shit, I was like, I don't know. But he has this kind of languid, you know, kind of, Aaron Quick, all my ghost stories, right?
Yeah.
And he's not doing a Crypt Keeper.
No.
He's not saying a bunch of puns and giggling, you know? Which is unfortunate. I think that would have been better if he was just doing a Crypt Keeper. Let me read to you the paragraph about... I won't read the whole paragraph, but from the paragraph about Christopher Lloyd's characterological decisions. Lloyd contributed a lot to the Quicksilver character, Garris says. Quote, he came up with his own costume idea and the red wig. He'd formulated his thoughts on Olivier's Hamlet, and so that inspired him in how he wanted the Quicksilver character to look. Obviously, we had a costume designer come in and design that leather outfit, which looked really odd. But we thought odd was a good thing for this, and Chris loved it. You hire him because you want Christopher Lloyd, and there's nobody like him. He is a lot like his characters. He's incredibly intelligent and funny and eccentric, but on the set, He's just quiet and thoughtful. And then when you ask him what to do what he does, and he's really great and really sweet and easy to work with, but he brings you a quality no one else brings you. To have him as the guy who would present his story each week, if it turned into a series, would have been a lot of fun. So Olivier's Hamlet is in the visual and acting styles of Aaron Quicksilver.
Well, I think I can see that, actually.
I also can see it now that someone said it, yeah.
Yeah, I just wouldn't have thought, like, because the character, he's very theatrical. Like, that is sort of the performance style. I would not have necessarily guessed that he went to Olivier's Hamlet for that.
Would you have guessed that he came with the idea for the red wig?
No, I also would not have guessed that.
You know, I was mentioning beforehand Doc Brown from Back to the Future. But he's also Uncle Fester.
Yes, he is. That's who he is for me.
What's different there for you?
I did not like the Back to the Future movies, and so I watched the Addams Family movies a lot more.
Is there a marquee part of that performance that's important for you? That sticks out? Oh, Marty, it's your parents. Marty, it's your kid. You know what I mean? Is there one of those for Fester for you?
Your first cigar. And then Raul Julia looks at him. It's like, I've been smoking since I was 5.
God, Raul Julia is so good in those movies.
He is.
When are we just going to do the Addams Family for fun?
I'm sure we can find it a reason to do that on Shell by Genre.
Yeah. Just an Addams Family unit. We just read a bunch of the comic. Good stuff. We get him, and then so here's an interesting thing. In the casting of this, it seems like Fox was like, if you get a couple big names, we don't care who else you use. So that is why Christopher Lloyd and Matt Frewer are in it, and then everyone else just seems to be a random person. Because they didn't have to go. And in fact, many of the people are random people. Because Mick Garris was able to shoot this, unlike, you know, The Shining miniseries, which was shot at the Stanley Hotel. Unlike The Stand, right, which was shot everywhere, seemingly. Unlike those things, Mick Garris basically shot this within driving distance of his home.
Okay.
So that every location is like in L.A. somewhere. And apparently the medical facility they use is like right down the street from his house. And so because it was so close to home and they wanted to keep costs so low, Mick Garris just called everyone he knew. And so basically every non-principal actor in this is some sort of cameo, even if you don't know who they are. Like some of them are like science fiction authors or like, real alien abduction stories, like those kinds of books. Bill Warren, who authored a 2-volume tome on 50 science fiction films, Keep Watching the Skies. He's in it.
Okay.
My uncle was the guy in the wheelchair. like in the book, he just goes through all the random people who are in this movie. Mm-hmm. So his
wife's in it. Yeah.
Yeah, Cynthia Garris is in it as a principal actor, which is fun. But so talk about the frame. I got us off track. The frame story, and it all lives on Christopher Lloyd's performance of this Olivier-esque leather daddy, Aaron Quicksilver.
So in the first story, we begin with a recently married couple whose vehicle has broken down in the desert. And the husband goes off to get help and leaves the wife behind. And then Aaron Quicksilver pulls up with his trailer that is bigger inside than it is outside. And he invites her in to hang out. And then he tells her a story. And sort of similarly, the frame story for the second one is a pickpocket played by Matt Frewer on a like boardwalk. I think it's actually the Santa Monica boardwalk, although they like changed out the sign. Or the Santa Monica Pier or whatever. And he wanders into like a tent, like a little like curiosity show attraction filled with all sorts of weird things in jars and whatnot. And then Aaron Quicksilver is there. And in the first case, he is... So the second one makes more sense than the first one. The first one is like, hey, young lady stuck in the desert, you want to hear a story about a guy who was also lost in the desert? Although I'm not gonna trick you here. The ending isn't that he's Jesus. It is.
He only had one set of footprints. Yeah. But yeah. Who was carrying him?
Right. So like this is kind of the hook of the show, is like the story that Quicksilver tells the person that he meets is starring the same actor who is playing that person. So in the Chattery Teeth segment, it weirdly flips such that the guy who was playing her husband is now playing a husband who is on the road trying to get home, and he's going to find the Chattery Teeth, and we'll talk about how all of that happens. But then when he calls home, it's the woman who was playing his wife outside of the story who is also playing his wife in the story. And then The Body Politic, again, this makes a bit more sense because he's a pickpocket, and Aaron Quicksilver is like, pickpocket. Let me
tell you about this cursed object that has nothing to do with your story.
the story itself is like, hey, what if your hands did things? So then Matt Frewer plays he's a plastic surgeon, I think is what they change him to. Because in the original story, I thought this was interesting. And knowing that the hospital was down the street from McGarris made this make a bit more sense. Because in the original story, I remember this, he is a like factory worker or a builder or something. So I was like, oh, why did they change him into being a plastic surgeon? So they could do a bunch of plastic surgery jokes mainly. So Quicksilver tells them the story that is also starring them. And then after that story is over, there's some sort of like quote unquote twist or kind of like dark little turn where after the lady hears the story about the Chattery Teeth, she then gets to see the Chattery Teeth dragging her husband's corpse through the desert for some reason.
Her recently hit by a car husband's corpse.
Yeah. Like,
is this a ghost?
Yeah, I don't know.
Okay, all right.
Like, it raises a lot of questions about what exactly just happened. Yeah. And the second one, Body Politic, makes slightly more sense because Matt Frewer is like, yeah, well, whatever. My hands are my own business. And then he leaves. And then his hands try to steal a gun from a cop of their own volition. And he gets arrested.
Yeah.
Crime doesn't pay, children.
You really want to try, you know, you want to try the defense. My hands did it on their own. my hands are fomenting revolution. But, yeah. So, this movie is a hot 90, you know? Mm-hmm. Like, it's right at 90 minutes. And it's basically split completely in half, something like that.
Yeah.
45-45?
Mm-hmm.
The things have nothing to do with one another.
No.
Like, they are just related by the frame story. And there is no effort to make the frame story related to itself. Because in the first one, he's got his Airstream. And in the second one, he's got his museum.
Mm-hmm.
So, there is no... You could saw these things in half and be perfectly fine. No missing nothing.
Yeah, I thought it was really weird that, like, because again, I expect, like, the thing about the Crypt Keeper is that he's in the crypt. That's where he hangs out. He's always there.
Yeah, he's down there cackling.
But Aaron Quicksilver, he's traveling the country, like, collecting stories. That's what he says in the first story, right? That's what he tells
from
them.
Coastal California, mm-hmm, to more inland California. Oh!
So it would make sense if, and because it's called Quicksilver Highway, right? It would make sense if every sequence had him being on the road or someone on the road meets him, right?
Yeah. He picks up a hitchhiker.
Yeah.
Easy.
Yeah. Yep. But nope. In the second one, he's just like, he's got a museum now. He doesn't have his Airstream.
Yeah. For the second one, it would have been so easy for him to pick up the hitchhiker, right? So Matt Frewer, he's in a little desert town, right? Mm-hmm. Or whatever. He's in a pit stop. He pickpockets somebody. He goes outside. He's looking for a ride. He's looking for an escape route. Aaron Quicksilver's out there. He goes out there, gets in the... Hell, he could just get in the Airstream. You know what I mean? He doesn't even have to get in the car. He's like, hey, can I... And he pretends to care about Aaron Quicksilver, right? To hear his stories, because he just wants to hide out, which is what happens in the frame story, right? Of the second story. Just have him do that. Have the same shit happen. Yeah. Just put it in the Airstream. Why? Why do this?
The Airstream trailer was very busy. They only had it for that one shoot.
That's right. Yeah, there was an equipment issue. It's the most booked Airstream trailer in Hollywood. Very popular. You got to book it a year out. But yeah, so that's the frame story. Christopher Lloyd's in both of them. He's doing something. But it's not particularly fun to watch. And the real difficulty of it, I think, is that the frame stories are really long.
Yeah.
You know, like a Twilight Zone, right? You get old Rod Serling, he goes, let me tell you about some fucked up shit that happened in the 1950s. Mm-hmm. And you're like, ooh. And at the end, he goes, wasn't that fucked up, kids? Eat your vegetables. And you're like, I'm gonna get turned into a creature, you know, or whatever. I don't want the Civil War to happen again in my backyard. No, thank you. You know, like that, and that, you know, in and out in terms of framework, you know, on the Twilight Zone. Even the Crypt Keeper, right? Crypt Keeper shows up and is like, hey, guess what? You ever thought about forks and spoons?
Right. I've got 90 seconds of intro here, if even that.
Yeah. You know, let me tell you a little story about a goblin. And then at the end, you know, he comes back and he says, you know, goblin these in your, you know, what, say, insert your rude.
These,
you know,
bones.
Ah!
Because he's the Crypt Keeper.
We can just do that for the next half hour if you want. You want the Crypt Keeper? I like the Crypt Keeper. He's good. He's a good little guy.
He is.
You know, in the same way that I often, in Shelved by Genre, or other show, you know, I like to talk about like a Tomie versus Sadako, you know? Mm-hmm, I like to talk about a Freddy versus Jason.
Mm-hmm.
I want to see, like a tell-em-off, you know, like a story competition.
Mm-hmm.
Crypt Keeper.
Mm-hmm.
Aaron Quicksilver. Jonathan Frakes. Who else? Who else we got? Rod Serling.
Well, yeah, Rod
Resurrect
Serling.
Him.
Who else is like hosting?
Hologram Rod Serling.
Yeah.
Yeah. Who? Well, let's see. Let's look at some other anthology TV shows. Anthology
I was going to say, TV I think shows. I'm immediately going to like the hosts, which is like the movie hosts, right? Your Elvira's and whatnot. And that's.
Oh,
not,
yeah.
That's
get Elvira
right.
in there.
Okay. Elvira can drop by, I guess. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Elvira counts. Joe Bob Briggs.
Okay, yeah.
I mean, I don't care for his, like, opinions on the world, but I'll watch him get stomped by the Crypt Keeper. you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, sometimes you gotta put a villain in there just to lose. That's
right.
Okay.
And the best thing about this event is that it's really going to put that lady from that I Think You Should Leave skit into work.
Which one?
The one where... the driving class one.
Oh yeah,
right, where she keeps making offhand comments about Freddy Krueger and the Crypt Keeper.
That's right.
And the students in the class are like, why was she hanging out with the Crypt Keeper?
Oh yeah, the horror convention or whatever.
Yeah.
Yep, that's good skit.
Mm-hmm.
You know, theoretically Tim Robinson could be in there because he does kind of perform
that
a Crypt Keeper role in that skit.
Yeah, he's like his own Crypt Keeper.
Mm-hmm. He kind of looks like the Crypt Keeper. A little bit. Zing. I'm just kidding, Tim Robinson. You don't look like Crypt Keeper. All right, let's talk about these stories as they work. Because as you said, the first frame story, just married couple, pregnant lady, husband goes off to do a hitchhike. And then Aaron Quicksilver shows up, puts her in his little creepy cabin, and then he tells her a story. Would you like to hear a story? And it's the story Chattery Teeth. Now, a little recap. That is in a Stephen King book we've read.
That's right.
Do you remember which one?
I believe Nightmares and Dreamscapes.
Yeah, I was quizzing you because I definitely knew.
Okay, yeah.
I had that one on lock, no question. And so it's about little chattery teeth that eat people.
Or one people.
I guess my assumption is it continued to or had in the past also. I assumed it was not like a solo, like on a lark. I'm some teeth. Maybe I'll give it a shot. I assume that was, but maybe it is.
Yeah.
But I didn't care for that story. But I think you do like that story. Is that the case?
No, I don't think I did. Nope.
You didn't like it either? You didn't like how it was a little goofy and silly?
I remember I think saying like this feels like it's one of those little like parody Stephen King stories, right? Like what if a set of chattery teeth was haunted?
I mean, that's a big question people are asking.
Mm-hmm.
And we have it here again. And we have it kind of, as far as my memory goes, pretty much beat for beat for a while.
Mm-hmm.
Which is like a traveling salesman on the road. Got to get home. Maybe this is invented for the story. I probably should have gone back to look at the story beforehand. But anyway, he's got to drive through a sandstorm. And he almost like smashes this hitchhiker on the way.
Mm-hmm.
And then he gets through it. And then he stops for snacks for some reason.
Mm-hmm.
He probably should have kept going. And he burns a solid 20 at this gas station. And then he gets back on the road and they get back in the storm. But he while he's at the gas station, he gets he's looking at some novelties. And he picks up a big old set of novelty teeth with feeties on them.
Mm-hmm.
And this is not in any universe what I imagine these little chattery teeth to look like. What do you think about this?
I actually imagined them bigger.
You imagine them bigger? These things are Cabbage Patch doll sized.
Yeah, I imagine them bigger. I mean, I think the story, if I'm remembering it right, makes a big deal about how they're unusually large and also like heavy. They feel like they're made out of metal or something.
Yeah, but the normal chattering teeth kind of thing, they're 2 inches tall.
Mm-hmm.
And this is like a He-Man action figure.
Yeah. I imagine
even this
bigger.
This is Stretch Armstrong size.
Yeah. I imagine.
And you thought they were 2 feet tall.
Not quite that big. I'm trying to think of like what's a good comparison for size. I don't know. Maybe about
Yorkshire Terrier.
Yes, maybe. Yes.
You thought that. What was the name of George W. Bush's dog?
I don't know. I don't know. Could we spend 45 minutes on this question?
Yeah, I'm going to. Scottish Terrier.
Mm-hmm.
Barney. Barney Bush was his dog. Whenever I think about a little dog, I think about George W. Bush's tiny dog. Look, I'll show you. Look, I got a picture.
Okay.
Here we go. Look at him, Barney Bush.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
Yeah, he's good.
Yeah.
Look, I don't care for George W. Bush, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I think he's bad. But Barney Bush didn't have anything to do with that.
Well, that dog
That's not
has
his
charisma.
Fault.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's just a little dog. I can't be mad at him because of what his owner did. Barney's mother, Coors, was owned by the former EPA director.
Coors.
Coors Bush. The dog's father's known as Kelly. The Bushes had another Scottish Terrier named Miss Beasley. And she's Barney's niece through his half-brother, Clinton.
Okay.
Citation needed on that one. Interesting that there's not enough information out there, enough published information about Barney the dog.
Mm-hmm.
This is from Bob Woodward's book, State of Denial, Bush at War, Part 3.
There's a section in there to dig into the genealogy of Barney the Terrier.
Sadly, no.
Okay.
These are just whoever wrote this Wikipedia page was like hitting it. They know what's up. Okay. Late last year, he had key Republicans up to the White House to talk about the war and said, "I will not withdraw, even if Laura and Barney are the only ones supporting me. Barney is his dog." Criticism. This is a subheading called Criticism by Karl Rove and Vladimir Putin.
Is this of the dog or of the book?
This is of the dog.
Okay.
White House official Karl Rove remarked shortly after his resignation that Barney was, quote, a lump. Barney has also been criticized by Russian President Vladimir Putin, who feels a world leader should own large, robust dogs, not smaller breeds such as the Scottish Terrier. At a later date, when Putin introduced Bush to Coney, his black Labrador, Putin is reported to have remarked that Coney is, quote, bigger, tougher, stronger, faster, meaner than Barney. God damn.
Oh, you're a child and you think adults run the world. And you're right, in a sense.
Yeah. But also, it seems like their dogs also kind of run the world. Mm-hmm. Like, would you have ever imagined that your wildest Pixar dreams are, like, kind of weirdly true? Like, mm-hmm. not in the way you think they might be. Like, they talk to one another and they have powers and abilities, but that they serve as proxies for state warfare?
Mm-hmm.
Very important dogs might, like, get in a vibes off with one another, and it might, like, determine policy.
Mm-hmm.
On November 6, 2008, Barney bit Reuters reporter John Decker's finger. Barney bit his finger, he says.
Wow.
In viral video, local reporter says, "Barney bit my finger." Anyway, here's what I was initially looking for, which is a picture of real-sized teeth. They're like palm-sized.
Yes.
But these are, yeah, like Stretch Armstrong size. You know, they're probably 8 inches tall. Mm-hmm. And you think they should be the size of Barney the dog.
Yeah, probably.
That's big.
That's about the same. Yeah, I don't know. That's just how I pictured them. I don't remember how they were described exactly. But I also maybe just imagine that because the teeth end up, like, I don't know, jumping around and doing all sorts of wacky shit. And it's less wacky, I think, if the mm-hmm. teeth are larger.
Yeah, weirdly enough, there is kind of an inverse wacky rule where uh-huh. there's a right size for wackiness. In a way that you might not think about, but I think that's right. I think that is true. Raphael Smarge? Smarge?
Yeah.
Plays the guy. He plays the salesman.
Mm-hmm.
I gotta say it. I don't think he's very good.
Okay. Oh my God! You don't think the beloved Carth Onassi from Star Wars: Knights of the Old Republic is any good?
I mean, I'm not saying he's, like, a bad actor.
Yeah.
Period. I just think he's very bad in this.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you're gonna have to. You might have some things to say about him soon.
Mm-hmm.
Because he's in a 2001 film called Pearl Harbor.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I guess I got to watch that.
Yep. In 1997, he was in Quicksilver Highway, Party of Five, Viper, The Parenthood, Dharma and Greg, and Breastmen?
Breastmen.
The TV movie Breastmen? Starring David Schwimmer? Hmm. And Chris Cooper?
Hmm.
Weird. They invent. It's about. It's like that Nike movie. You know, like the Nike documentary, how they made, like, the Air Jordans or whatever.
Uh huh.
It's like that, but for breast implants.
Great.
But follow different life paths. It's about the doctors. They follow different life paths thereafter. Dr. Saunders becoming a narcissist interested in developing and implanting the exaggerated larger sized types of implants popular with a mostly exotic dancer and female porn star clientele. That's David Schwimmer, I think. He's going wild out there. Anyway, I don't think Raphael Sabarge is very good, but I do think that Silas Weir Mitchell playing the hitchhiker, because he almost hits the hitchhiker.
Mm-hmm.
The hitchhiker needs money for cigarettes. He gives the hitchhiker some money for cigarettes later on. He puts him, the hitchhiker needs a ride, and he lets the hitchhiker have a ride. You know, that's pretty good. Like, pretty cool stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And then guess what? That fucking hitchhiker turns on him. He's got a blade.
Yep.
And he's going to carjack him.
Yep.
Silas Weir Mitchell went to Brown.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting.
Did you see that under his relatives here on Wikipedia is Silas Weir Mitchell, the physician and poet?
No. I don't know who that is.
It's like he's like a 19th century American poet. Now, because I was like, Silas Weir Mitchell, why do I know that name? I didn't watch any of these shows. And then I saw relatives, also Silas Weir Mitchell. And I was like, oh, the poet.
Hmm. Well, so I think he's great. Like, I really like Silas Weir Mitchell as a character actor. He is in My Name is Earl, mm-hmm. as like an eternal fuck up guy,
mm-hmm.
Who was like, wants to do good, but can never do good, you know? Can't ever make it happen. And he's really good as that character, I think. And I think he does a really good job here. I think part of the issue with this movie.
Mm-hmm. I have to say, I didn't know him because of the poet. I know him because he was the doctor who specifically was recommending the like isolation, stay in your bed postpartum treatments that Charlotte Perkins Gilman said almost drove her nuts and that she wrote the yellow wallpaper about.
Oh my God.
Yeah. So, sorry, back to the other Silas Weir Mitchell.
From postpartum depression treatments to My Name is Earl, the Just King Things experience is for everybody. That's wild. Yeah, you know, if you're a 19th century physician, you got like a photo like that made of you, you know, you got some crazy ass opinions on science.
Mm-hmm.
Just wild shit you're out there saying. Rad. But yeah, I think he's great. I love this actor.
Yeah, no, I think he's doing a good job.
I think this is a movie, unfortunately. I normally think that McGarris gives people a lot of room to determine their character and to perform their character. You know, you got to clear some pathway for Gary Sinise. You got to clear some pathway for Ed Harris.
Mm-hmm.
No one in this film, I think because of the timing on it, because of the budget, because the kind of we're making a film for fun kind of thing.
Yeah.
I don't think there's pathway for anyone to really perform much of anything.
Yeah.
And so I think it's a little disappointing. He does that, and he starts to kind of do a little carjacking. And our salesman, he responds to that by like wiggling around on the road. You know what I mean? Like, because they're driving through a sandstorm. And so there's not, you know, like what's that performance? What could you do? Right. So like really he just like wiggles and jiggles the car a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
He does that, and he wiggles and jiggles so bad that he almost runs into a big tanker truck, and then they roll off the road. And then the hitchhiker is like real mad.
Mm-hmm.
And he starts like doing his own wiggling and jiggling with a knife.
Yeah.
And then gets killed by the stuff.
Yeah. Those teeth kill him.
Mm-hmm, because the driver, the salesman says, bite him! Bite him!
Yeah.
You know, he's just like kind of going for anything. Bite him! And he does.
Yep.
And then he chomps them all up. 1 year later, he comes back through. He sees the lady at the counter at mm-hmm. the station.
It used to be the little like pit stop. It used to be like a really sort of grody roadside attraction with like, you know, the quote unquote zoo mm-hmm, where they have like lots of sort of exotic animals and not
raccoon
great
in a cage.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a place that I once went that was like this. It was just like that vibe. I was like looking for, I think, a washer or a dryer. It was like an appliance store and it was just run out of something like some building in Indianapolis. And there was a gigantic iguana in a kiddie pool hanging out in the middle of all the washers and dryers.
And how was it?
It seemed like a very sad iguana.
Yeah.
So that's the kind
of morally you got to like free these animals.
Yeah. And in fact, that's like an argument that the wife and the husband are having initially, is because he's like all about these animals or whatever. So a year later, he's gone. He's like died or something. And she has redone the entire pit stop into just like, you know, a quaint little diner.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, so he dies of, quote unquote, the cancer.
Mm-hmm.
And you know what? Let me get on a pedestal for a minute here. No, not a pedestal. What is it? A pulpit.
I don't know.
Here
okay.
we go. In there's a maneuver that is made sometimes in Stephen King, but mostly just in like movies that are trying to hit the tone of Stephen King, where people of a vaguely Southern persuasion, you know, like ambiently Southern, yeah. ambiently hick or hillbilly, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Will call things the cancer.
Mm-hmm.
With the was a definite article?
Yes.
With a definite article in front. The cancer.
Mm-hmm.
I am from the hillbilly South. My family is from, you know, as they would have said on Squidbillies, the backwoods butt crack of Georgia.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, some of them are from the backwoods butt crack of Tennessee.
Ooh.
An even more hillbillyized part of the country. I've never heard a single human being in real life say the cancer. Have you?
No, I haven't. And my family is from the part of Tennessee that is actually Southern Kentucky. So
The armpit, as
mm-hmm.
it were.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So like I've been exposed to the people who would say it if people said it.
Right. Same. Right. So my supposition is, what a load of horse shit. I'm tired of it. I don't want to hear about the cancer no more. Just say it. Just say cancer. All right. I'm off my pulpit. Mm-hmm. I'm now sitting back in the pew.
Mm-hmm.
The choir is doing their thing. They got mm-hmm. a tambourine.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I'm putting the chattery teeth on a pedestal.
Now it's
I'm setting myself up
thing.
For disappointment.
I just thought the chattery teeth had a vision of the future, you know? There just seemed to be a week, you know, he steps down, we get the new candidate. It's the chattery teeth. You know, one campaign promise, I'll eat my enemies. You go, all right. That's interesting. No one's really promised that
Coward
before.
Donald Trump drops out of debate with chattery teeth.
But, you know, then you get the statements and they start, mm-hmm. you know, it's politics as usual with chattery teeth, of course, mm-hmm. always. Mm-hmm. But yeah, that you know, they go back, that has occurred. And then she's like, yeah, that fucking hitchhiker, he is, they found him in the desert all chewed up.
Mm-hmm.
Which I think happened in the book as well.
Yes.
And then the end.
Well, no. She's also like, and here's those chattery teeth that you bought. They must have gotten lost in the storm.
Yeah, I found them all. No, not even they got lost in the storm. She says she went out the next day and they were on the stoop outside.
Oh, yeah.
So she said, you must have dropped them. And she's like, they're yours. And then I have to think, well, no. Because it seems like what the chattery teeth did is they went home.
Mm-hmm.
Like, this is their house. They went, and you're trying to give them away? No. They live here. Keep them. But, yeah, I think they should, like, eat his kids or something at the end. You know, you got to pay a debt.
Yeah. No, for a Tales from the Crypt story type story, this sort of works in that, like, yeah, this ends with him being like, well, I guess these in the original, the King story makes this very clear. He's basically like, yeah, I guess these are my pet murder teeth, like, that want to protect me. And that can be the end of a Tales from the Crypt story, right? This kind of like, well, I guess I got the murder teeth now. They're my pet. But then the frame of this makes it super weird because it scopes back out into what I already said, that she like sees her husband get hit. He's hitchhiking and he gets hit. And then the chattery teeth drag him into the desert and she's just like screaming or something. And what? Like, I mean, there doesn't have to be moral sense to the universe, but there's so little in the way of like moral or narrative sense to what happens here.
Yeah. And it seems like, well, why would her husband be hit right outside the airstream?
Right.
So it seems like we're seeing like a ghost recollection of something else.
Yes. Right. Like a vision.
Yeah, that happened down the line. I don't know. It's a little unclear. I think the chattery teeth should have ended. You could shoot two more setups, right? One is that he doesn't have the chattery teeth anymore, and he's got to, like, he still has to buy a present. No, you know what? We don't even have to do that part. All right. So instead of cutting back to the, you know, 1 year later to the diner, he's in the hospital. He's all beefed up, you know, from his accident. His wife and kid are there. And they find a present in the room. And he clearly is confused. He's like, I didn't get, you know, I'm hurt. And she says, oh, you know, his wife fills in. Oh, you bought this before? You bought this before, you know, you got in your accident? And he, like, you know, because he's a little worm of a guy. He goes, yeah. Kid opens it up. Birthday present. Kid opens it up. Chattery teeth in there. You know what I mean? Easy. But yeah, well, that kind of ends. Let's just cut to next story.
Yep. So we got the setup here. It's the guy, Matt Frewer, being a pickpocket. He goes into the little, like, curiosity tent. Aaron Quicksilver is like, look at this, the hand of glory, blah, 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 blah. And then we jump into the actual story, the body politic.
Yeah, that's kind of a bummer to me. Number one, because it doesn't matter at all for the rest of the story, like even a little bit. Number two, a hand of glory is pretty cool.
They are.
They're a pretty neat thing in terms of, like, I don't know, what is the word? Magic? Folklore? Mm-hmm. What are they?
Yeah, I mean, it's like folklore, like occult stuff, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, it's neat. There's a really great, maybe you've read this Hellboy comic. Have you read that Hellboy comic where the guy paralyzes Hellboy with a hand of glory?
I think so, yes.
It's pretty neat. He gets turned into a lizard at the end.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, but yeah, so we get right into that. Sorry, I just wanted to pause on the hand of glory because it's a cool setup for nothing. I do like that Matt Frewer. I like, you know, there's, they talk about some actors have it, some actors don't, you know, there's something to screen presence and there's something to, like, having a face for TV, that kind of thing. Matt Frewer's got it.
Yeah.
Like, I look at Matt Frewer, I'm like, that's an actor. That's a TV guy. Mm-hmm. He's doing the thing. And I think he does a great job.
He does. In this
little thing, this little short film, The Body Politic, is fundamentally silly, and it could not work at all. And as a movie, it does not work. But as a short, as a 30-minute, 35-minute short film, I think it's perfectly fine.
Yeah. Well, it's it's Clive Barker, and it's notable because it's one of Clive Barker's kind of dark comedy stories. Which he has, you know, a handful of, like, that's a mode that he operates in sometimes.
Handful of?
And he is, I would say, in general, probably better at it than Stephen King. Because when Stephen King wants to be funny, you get something like, like almost like In the Death Room or whatever, or like Autopsy Room 4, which is always a little, like, I don't know. It's like juvenile. And this is a story about a bunch of hands that come to life and, like, chop themselves off of their people and start killing other people, which is, like, not exactly mature. But Barker tends to handle the mixture of, like, the absurd in the comic and the horrific in a different way that actually, like, they're genuine horror comedies, right? Like, I feel like when Barker sets his mind to it, he can actually do a story that is both funny and scary, whereas Steve usually ends up tipping into just goofy as hell.
Yeah, and I think that probably has to do with when Clive Barker does that, he often will go into kind of austerity. Stephen King cannot write an austere story. He tries occasionally, and he can't deliver on a sketch. And I don't even know. That sounds like a real criticism, but it isn't. Like, that's just not a style that he works in. He works in a really kind of ornate style. You know, that Stephen King loves to explain in his fiction. He loves to give you a lot of detail. He loves to give you a lot of kind of internal monologue. And Clive Barker is kind of the flip in that he is very good. If he wants to give you those things, he can. But I think that mostly stylistically, Clive Barker works by turning one or more of those things off. that he clearly has a mental model of what these characters are doing and what they're doing, but he gives the reader tactical glimpses into pieces of the world. And that's why some of his stories are so disturbing, you know, like in the Hills, the Cities, mm-hmm. you know, one of the best short stories ever written. You mm-hmm. know, I think that's an easy thing for me to say. If you've not read In the Hills, the Cities, is Clive Barker's story. It's in the Books of Blood. You can get mm-hmm. it really cheap. I'm sure it's actually probably online somewhere you could read it. It is just an apex short story. If you want to learn how short stories work, you can read it, and you can probably like work back from there to like invent the short story format. Right.
It is often named as not just you know, one of the best short stories, but it is named as specifically like, if you want to know what Clive Barker can really do, this is one of the stories that you read.
Yeah. And it works by, you get a snapshot of character psychology, just enough to give you a sense of what these people are like. You get a snapshot of environment, right? And sometimes this kind of languid environmental stuff, you get these really quick glimmers of how a character is perceiving their world as opposed to how we're being shown that world, right? He turns off and on all these kind of different hoses or whatever. Unfortunately, you kind of can't translate that to film because you can't. Mm-hmm. I mean, you could theoretically in a world of infinite time and money and capability. But that's not what this short story is, you know, and that's not what this short film is. Do you want me to just like hit what the thing is about?
I mean, sure. Although, yeah, go ahead.
Plastic surgeon, his hands come alive and begin to rebel mm-hmm. and foment revolution in the world.
Mm-hmm.
One seems to be Christ, like a hand Christ.
Yes.
Some sort of Christ plus Che Guevara kind of character.
Yeah, it thinks it's Christ or whatever. Like the story is to some degree like a parody of revolutionary sentiment writ large.
Yes, yeah. Well, there's eventually like a Viva la Revolution.
Yeah.
You know, and you're like, all right. All right, McGarris. But, anyway, he chops his hand off, and it goes and builds an army.
Mm-hmm.
And by liberating other people's hands from them, and mm-hmm. then they attack a bunch of people, and then he kills his hand, and that all the other hands follow suit and die. Right?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Thus the way of all revolutions.
Of course.
When the leader falls off a building, so do all the people who follow them.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, cult mentality for mm-hmm. the hands. But in the middle, there's a lot of, what's the little hand's name? Tickety, tickety, tickety.
Thing.
Of course. How would I ever confuse it and Thing?
Mm-hmm.
But there's a lot of Thing from the Addams Family to the point where they are just lifting the way that creature moves in the Addams Family.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's the same performer as well.
Is it really?
Yes, it is literally the same performer, Christopher Hart, who's like a magician and like a hand model. He provided the hand for Thing in the 90s Addams Family movies, and he's playing all the hands here.
Oh, that's fun. Mm-hmm. My estimation of that has gone up 5,000%. But there's a lot of that, and then there's a lot of Matt Frewer doing kind of idle hands. Some like handwork, hands speaking to one another,
mm-hmm.
hands wiggling and jiggling around on their own, hands doing things you don't want them to do.
Mm-hmm.
He's having to do a lot of handwork.
Mm-hmm.
And that's it.
Yep. 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 Yep.
What are some things that stick out to you about it?
Okay, so we've got a Cynthia Garris cameo as his mm-hmm. wife. Mm-hmm. They have some like real intimate moments, and then his hands kill her.
His hands are, they work better than they've ever worked before, Michael. You know what I mean? They're like, mm-hmm. and it's for a TV movie on Fox.
Yeah,
when that hand comes out, where they're in the bath together or something.
Mm-hmm.
When his hand comes out, it's glistening wet.
Yeah.
Obviously, it's from the water.
Mm-hmm.
But also, I was like, I can't believe this is on Fox.
I was, yeah, like the scene where he gets into the kitchen and he cleaves off his hand.
Yeah.
I was like, oh, wow. Like, they showed that on TV. Because it's not, like, super bloody, but, like, you see the cleaver go in.
Yeah, it looks like a really, like, solid magic trick.
Yes.
Yeah, you watch it kind of those videos like, is it cake?
Yes, exactly.
Mm-hmm. It's one of those.
I was thinking that too.
You're like, wow, it's just like the cake. So there's some sexually risque, content for 7 p.m., mm-hmm. On Fox and also some violence there. I made many little GIFs. I guess I'll put them on Twitter when... Or I'll give them to you to put on co-hosts too.
Okay.
For when this episode comes out. Or you've got them, so you can just use them. But yeah. I made them to send to Michael of the hand running around in effect shots because it's very funny to me. But that's kind of what goes on here. You want to hear some I got it here. Gosh. I had
trivia?
Matt Frewer talking about I had Matt Frewer talking about the thing.
Here we go.
Yeah, if you got one.
While you vamp, I could tell like the Matt Frewer story that I have about this.
Yeah, please.
So we've seen Matt Frewer before multiple times. I can't even actually count the times because I know it's at the very least two, probably three, and frankly, probably more. It seems like he's shown up in a lot of these. Previously, I have compared him and kind of his energy to a little bit to like Jim Carrey.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And he's got that here, but the thing that was really striking to me was even his like tone of voice was kind of like he was doing a like Jim Carrey style voice that I in a way that I thought was like really weird and anomalous. So I was just looking through what he has done. The other thing is that I think in a lot of the Matt Frewer work that we've seen for this show, like his most prominent role has been the Trash Can Man. So he's not really doing his normal elocution there. So I was like, what's going on here? I looked into it. Weirdly enough, in the 90s, he voiced Jim Carrey's character Lloyd Christmas in the children's Saturday morning cartoon adaptation of Dumb and Dumber, which maybe is what like set me on the path of thinking he had Jim Carrey energy to begin with. The other weird thing about this is that the Jeff Daniels character from that film, mm-hmm. his cartoon version is voiced by Bill Fagerbakke, or Bach, I don't know how to pronounce that last name, who played Tom Cullen in The Stand. So Fagerbakke. Okay. So like, just, I don't know. It's interesting that those two guys ended up working together across time in that way.
Yeah. If people have not listened to it in our, Mick Garris's The Stand episode, he's also Patrick Starfish.
Yes. And in that same cartoon, Lloyd and I think Harry is the other character. They have a dog. That dog is voiced by Tom Kenny, who voices SpongeBob.
Oh my God.
It's almost like this is some sort of industry with a bunch of people who are coworkers.
Oh my God. I can't believe it. I'm trying to find this anecdote in the book here. I don't know why I can't find it. In the previous sketch, there's that dust going everywhere.
Yeah.
That's called something's Earth, like someone's name, Earth.
Huh? What?
It's like an effects dirt. It's not real dust or dirt, so it's like someone's name Earth.
I thought you meant like as a geographic or meteorological phenomenon.
No. Okay. Like as an effects dirt.
Okay.
And they used to use it all the time in Hollywood. Mm-hmm. And I guess in the early 2000s, they found out it was hella carcinogenic.
Ooh, boy.
So people have been using it and breathing it in for years.
Mm-hmm.
And then they started using ground up walnut dust, apparently. And
oh, I'm sure that's great for people.
I guess so. I guess it's not as bad as whatever, as some other thing. But I can't find it where they're talking about it. Let me read this Matt Frewer thing here. God, I've lost it again. Oh, here we go. Okay. Because talking about the performance of Matt Frewer, right? Because he's got a lot to do. Mm-hmm. He's doing the big kind of actions of liposuction. We see some of that. Notably in the scene where he's performing liposuction, he is John Landis is in that scene.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
and so is Clive Barker. And Clive Barker delivers the most, I find Clive Barker delightful. I think he looks great. He's got, especially 90s Clive Barker. You know, we talked about that in, Sleepwalkers?
Yeah, because he gets a cameo in Sleepwalkers, too.
Yeah, and John Landis does, too. And Stephen King's in that scene, too, right?
Yeah.
Like, they're all three. Stephen King does not appear in Quicksilver Highway, interestingly enough. But in between, so Clive Barker's got, you know, this wonderful, like, young Clive Barker look in Sleepwalkers. And he's still a young guy here, too. He's only 5-6 years later. But he's got a beard now.
Mm-hmm.
He's got his beard and his like little earring. I think he's such a great looking guy. I just think he's an iconic horror author to me.
Mm-hmm.
But so he's here. But Frewer talks about in this book, he got interviewed for the Garris biography. He says this of his physical acting in this. Here's a paragraph about the medical stuff. I'm not going to read that, but here's after that. But Frewer says what he remembers more about Body Politic is that, quote, we were rehearsing the scene where his hand mutinies on him for the first time, and I remember I fell on the floor, and I'm basically wrestling with my own hand in that Dr. Strangelove way, and Mick was setting up the camera. He's lying on the carpet, and we're face-to-face, and I'm making my own hand crawl up my shoulder and up to my face. We're looking at each other, and we just started killing ourselves laughing. It was like we both thought, oh my God, what are we doing? The whole thing just seemed remarkably silly instantly, but it was great fun to do. And I like this short film more than the previous short film. But if I have to sum them up in one phrase, this is me talking now. This is not me reading.
Okay.
Matt Frewer, by the way. If I have to sum them up in one phrase, I would say, the whole thing is remarkably silly.
Yeah.
And I don't think that's a tone that Mick Garris works well in, remarkably silly.
Yeah, I don't think so either.
Would you like to read, or would you like to hear from the book, the things people said about it after it came out?
Sure thing.
Okay. Two things. One, this is Mick Garris speaking. Quote, it was up against the finality of some big reality show and May Sweeps's other items and not promoted at all. Nobody expected to see TV movies on Fox, so nobody saw it. It was completely dropped into oblivion. I really liked the movie and almost no one has seen it. It was not theatrical in other countries. It may have sold to other countries. End quote. So, and I know for a fact, actually, for us prepping for this episode, we've gotten some messages from people that have been like, how do I watch this? You watch it on YouTube?
Yes, I did. can't exactly recommend, but, you know.
I mean, it's in like straight up potato quality, right?
Yes, it is. It really threw me back to like late high school, early undergrad, back when people would upload full movies from YouTube in 10-minute chunks.
Oh, right.
Yep.
I have the DVD, and it only ended up with the DVD in a really weird way, because it's actually kind of pricey. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, you look it up, I think it's like minimum $30 for this DVD, which is like pretty bare bones. It, by the way, it does have a commentary track, but because I had the Mick Garris book, and I really just could not in my mind imagine watching the movie a second time, I didn't see it. So if you have seen it and there's like some true gold in there, let me know. But it's with Mick Garris and Cynthia Garris. So maybe I should have watched it, but I didn't. it's pretty pricey. It has the ugliest and worst cover of anything I've ever seen. Have you seen the cover of it? Did I show this to you?
Oh, I think maybe you did, or at least I have some feeling that I do. But also, I don't know. Show it to me again.
Okay, it's Quicksilver Highway. Let me see if it's online. Because I might have to send you a... No, okay, good. It is. It is one of the weirdest covers I've ever seen, because the author, or the... Yeah, the author names, Stephen King and Clive Barker, are included in a quotation. Do you see?
Wait, what? Oh, huh.
Right? So it's a red cover with a Christopher Lloyd's eyeballs in the background.
This is interesting.
Isn't it weird?
It's like they couldn't get away with, like, this is maybe the only way they could like legally get the names of the authors onto the cover.
I do wonder. I do wonder if there's like some sort of rights or weird permissions thing going on with that.
Because we've at a couple points, we've stumbled upon situations where like Stephen King's such and such has been.
Yeah.
A fraught point.
Yes. Yeah, you know, sued to get his name off the Lawnmower Man.
Right.
You know, we talked about that. And also, Mick Garris has talked about that before, that he got to have his name on it because at that time, I guess there was, and maybe that's still the case, but there were DGA rules that if you put the author's name on it, then the director's name also had to go up on it. So it benefited him in interesting ways. Mm-hmm. But yeah, so it's got Stephen King, look it up, you know, listener. But it has Stephen King in big letters on the top and Clive Barker in big letters on the bottom. But it is within a quotation of Fright Titan Stephen King and Clive Barker send a shiver up your spine from the LA Times,
mm-hmm.
which is bewildering to me because that there is nothing in here that's scary in any kind of way. And I know sometimes we say that and people go, well, I got scared. And it's like, that's okay. I'm not here to police your like thoughts and feelings. But I also think that this is pretty far away from being any kind of scary whatsoever.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not... I think what's sad about this to me is that it doesn't even have anything that I would call like a characteristic Mick Garris flourish anywhere.
Yeah.
It's just real by the numbers. And it's sad. But here's the second quotation I want to read about the promotion of it. So came out on Fox, died on the vine. You know, no one cared about it, not promoted whatsoever. But we live in a time after that. By the way, I guess maybe I'm wrong on the DVD costs here. Looking like on the Bald Devil's website, looking like you can spend $12 plus shipping. So if you want to listen to the commentary, you can do that. And hopefully you have a DVD player. But this is Mick Garris talking about the afterlife of the film.
Okay.
Or actually the release and then the afterlife. This was the early days of online stuff, talking about the release of it. This was the early days of online stuff, Garris says. When people were online, horror fans would often seek things out. Some of them got it and loved it, but it was amazing to me how many people didn't. I think it was mostly the younger, teenaged horror audience that didn't get the sense of humor that Body Politic had. I thought it was pretty overt, not just satirical, but even slapstick at times. It was like, wait, I'm not used to my horror acting like this. It's popped up lately on video and the like, and people seem to appreciate it more now. The Television Academy showed its appreciation for the Quicksilver Highway score by nominating Mark Mothersbaugh for the Emmy for Outstanding Music Composition for a miniseries or special dramatic underscore. It was a lot of fun, says Garris, and I learned stuff. But the whole point in writing a book, making a movie, or recording an album is connecting with an audience. And when you don't, and or there are either no reviews or bad reviews, almost nobody reviewed it, and the handful of reviews that showed up are almost all negative, nobody appreciated what we were trying to do. First of all, mainstream television reviewers hated horror, never wrote about it, and it was always the poor stepchild, is his phrase. The amazing news was that The Stand and The Shining both were really well-received, and The Shining even better than The Stand. But it's always disappointing when you don't connect with an audience, because that's the whole point. Otherwise, you're just masturbating with a camera.
Eee.
And then he has some positive stuff to say about himself, where he says, "No, not every time at bat is going to be a home run," he says, which is that's the positive Mick Garris attitude that I like. Mm-hmm. I want to say this. I agree with all that. I think that, you know, I think you and I, Michael, we have strong feelings about horror, right? Mm-hmm. We like horror.
Mm-hmm.
I think we both like slapsticky horror, right? Yeah, I think we both have a slightly different threshold for that, but, you know, you can go and listen to us over on the Shelf by Genre bonus episodes with Austin, where we watch Evil Dead 2. We both express a real appreciation for that.
Yeah.
I like horror slapstick. I have a different, I have a different feeling about that sometimes. I think you have a higher threshold maybe for high tier goofery than I do.
I don't know. I feel like it really varies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think it's, I think you are also more sensitive to performance maybe.
Mm-hmm.
Like I have a lower threshold for the gag, but I have a higher threshold for bad performance.
Yeah.
I think maybe you're flip on that. You have a higher threshold, you know, you'll go for the gag. But I have to say this as an appreciator. I am core. I'm Quicksilver Highway core, right? Mm-hmm. I'm highway pilled. Like, I should be the person who would appreciate this the most, or at least have the doorway open to me doing it more than some sort of newfangled TV critic from 1997. And I don't think this is very good.
Yeah. I mean, I love kind of anthology. Like, I love Tales from the Crypt, right? Like, yeah. I love conceptually, like, Weirdo Tells You Stories anthology, right? So this is everything that I should like. And it did get me to start thinking, like, oh man, what's my Crypt Keeper? Because this, like, for the way that Aaron Quicksilver is like, you know, someone tried to come up with their own Crypt Keeper. I was like, I think I could do better than this, but I don't know what
Let's
I would do.
Let's come up with a Crypt Keeper. Let's do it.
Okay. Okay.
Where does he live? Because that's important. There's an abode, right?
Yes, there has to be an abode.
Rod Serling lives in the TV.
That's really basically true, yes.
Yeah, that's why, that's a joke, but that's like, that's part of the bit. He lives in there.
Yeah.
He lives in the TV. You know, Aaron Quicksilver lives in his Airstream trailer. The Crypt Keeper lives in the crypt.
Yeah. Like, what's it? We need
Joe Bob Riggs lives at the drive-in. Elvira lives in her house.
What about an attic? What if something lived in an attic? Or
that's good.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. In the attic.
Okay.
We could start the show always starts with a master shot of the house, and then we, you know, we close in on a glowing window, mm-hmm. and then we push through the window. Inside is
a really creepy grandma. I don't know.
Oh, hell yeah, yeah, grandma.
Yes.
And she's like kind of like Elvira style. You know, mm-hmm. she doesn't have like you know, a huge amount of cleavage out or whatever, right? That's Elvira's thing. We don't want to bite Elvira at all.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But maybe she's kind of like a hot grandma.
I okay, sure.
You're gonna go the other way? You're gonna go the like this is where we diverge. I think. Where's the swerve?
Oh yeah.
Kind of a hot grandma.
Yeah, no. I imagine that her being a bit more crypt keeper-ish. Like, mm-hmm. I don't know. Is this some sort of like corpse grandma who's been like left in the attic and has revived?
Okay.
Right?
Kind of like a psycho, like the mom from
yes,
Psycho.
Yes, exactly.
Okay. Right. All right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Hey, we're going. Oh, and she's constantly shouting downstairs, so we get the riff.
Yes.
Right. Uh-huh. You'll hear things off screen, like rat. You know, a cat. You know, yowling, mm-hmm. that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And like maybe like a Leatherface dude noises, you know, like the heavy breathing.
Right. There's always like, a reference
keep it down,
to like
down there.
Yes. Right. She's got like a family downstairs who make like occasional appearances or like we see glimpses of like figures down there or something.
I think this is good.
Mm-hmm.
And I think my version of this is what is her name? Mary Steenburgen.
Oh, okay,
and she's like polite, hot grandma.
Okay, actually, Mary Steenburgen could be very fun with this kind of thing.
Yeah. I think these can be two separate pitches, right? And like in the room, we would do that. I would say hot grandma, and I would look at the executive. I go, hot grandma? And if they're frowning, I go, you know, hot in a certain capacity. And then you launch into scary grandma,
mm-hmm,
you know?
Mm-hmm.
But if their eyebrows go up, then we go into the Mary Steenburgen pitch. you know, and that's more of a like a Shyamalan, like mildly threatening hot grandma in the attic.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And that's a different kind of thing. Boom, we got it.
Yeah.
Mick, you landed on fucking Aaron Quicksilver and hot grandma in the attic was available to you? We came up with that in 10 seconds. Christopher Lloyd wearing the weirdest collar you've ever seen? Looking so uncomfortable?
Yeah.
That's maybe the issue, is he looks uncomfortable.
He does, yeah.
He just wanted to wear his red wig. He just wanted to sing like Jack Skellington.
Mm-hmm. Oh, R.I.P. Danny Elfman.
Yep.
What were we talking about before we diverted onto this?
Before we made our own Crypt Keeper?
Yeah.
The Attic Grandma? I have no idea.
It was like why I feel like I am the audience for this, right?
Oh, yeah.
Because I love that type of character.
Yeah.
So, yeah, like, I just, this didn't have, as they say, it didn't really have the juice in terms of its framing device.
Yeah.
Chattery Teeth is not a story that I like a whole lot or care much about, like, whatever. It felt, like, appropriate to what this thing was trying to be in the sense, like, I could see it as you know, something that we watched on a Saturday evening in the 90s. But The Body Politic is actually a story that I have pretty fond memories of, and not just of it being kind of silly, but also specifically of it doing the thing that I said of being both kind of absurd and scary. It's actually kind of, it's got kind of a Junji Ito energy, I would say, where it's like, you know, on the one hand, it is totally absurd that these hands are just becoming, you know, like conscious and like chopping themselves off and then like killing their owners or whatever. And also there's a point in that story where it's just like, yeah, this is just happening, man. Like it's, it gets like the problem gets to be so big and so widespread because these hands are just like crawling around like the city and they're like going into people's houses while they sleep, crawling up on their beds and touching their hands and making their hands like wake up and then kill them. And it becomes this kind of like a massive absurd problem that just won't go away that I remember being very impactful on me early, because this is probably even before I knew about Junji Ito when I was reading that. But it's that kind of tone. And this, like I, you know, good on them for trying the kind of effects heavy approach and everything. Like it's an effects heavy story, it would have to be, and sort of going for it. But it also ultimately, I don't think like captures what was compelling to me about the original story. So.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think the original story is good. I there's what, four books of blood?
I think maybe six. Isn't it six?
I have no idea. I've only read up through the first four. Let's look here. Books of Blood is famous. The short story for Hellraiser is in Books of Blood 1, right?
Yes. It's, yeah, it's six horror fiction anthologies.
Wow. I've only read the first four.
Yeah.
Wow, yeah, 1 through 3 and 4 through 6. They're, oh, so it looks like you can get them in two collected volumes. Well, damn, there's two more books of blood for me to read.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know about what happened with Clive Barker going into a coma? Did we talk about that?
I heard about it. I don't know if we talked about it.
Oh, okay. I thought we talked about it maybe on the show. But yeah, he, you know, he, Clive Barker has a very famous habit, I think is probably the best word, where he will like start a trilogy or start several song or, you know, not songs, but several like book series and write the first couple books and just stop. And he's done that several times.
Yeah.
He's apparently, so he went into a coma in like 2012 or 2014 and his writing has been very sporadic since then. Sorry, he went to a coma and came out of the coma.
Yeah.
I guess the way I phrase that might make it sound like he's in a coma currently.
Strangely enough, he went into a coma and stopped writing.
Yeah, he just quit doing it. But but it really slowed his writing down a lot. But apparently he's kind of like back at it. I saw an interview with him fairly recently where he's talking about kind of being back in the game and writing some more, which is cool. It's great. It's kind of hard to go wrong with a Clive Barker book, I think. Like, yeah. The floor is pretty high to me. Although I have not read Mr. Maximilian Bacchus's In Traveling Circus. So I can't recommend them all. But yeah. For the most part, I've liked everything that I've read.
Yeah.
Anything else?
No, I don't think so. I'm looking through my notes here. That's it for like the thing. I can turn to our question from the question sewer.
Yeah, let's do it. Let's hear it. Question
sewer. All right. So, appropriately enough, I've got a question here from Eric, writing in with subject line, Mick Garris question.
Our fella.
Howdy, Michael and Cameron. You've mentioned several times on the podcast that you want to have Mick Garris on the show, but you've also mentioned several times that you do not want to talk to Stephen King on the show. What if Garris finally agrees to come on, but insists upon bringing King along? Will you bend and let Uncle Steve appear on JKT, or will you refuse?
I mean, I have an immediate answer, but what is your answer?
I am a little bit too enraptured by imagining like us waking up in the basement from Saw. And
hello, like, Michael.
Yeah,
Michael,
right.
Are you ready to play a game? It's me, Mick Garris. I'm ready to come on your podcast, but you must let my friend Stephen King come on it with me. Inside of Stephen King, there is one key.
Oh no, my uncle.
I think it would maybe depend on whether or not he wants Stephen King to be there with him, because on the one hand, that could be interesting. And on the other hand, like four of us on one recording, wow, that could get pretty wild. And in general, I am willing to talk with Mick about things, but I want to continue to put Steve on the pedestal. I want to hold him at a distance. So I would maybe say no.
Yeah, I would say no. Easy. Yeah. Mm-hmm. No question. Mick Garris will never be on our show. Like, it's just, you know what I mean? Like, the opportunity has passed, I believe. I think basically he is like down to personal appearances. I mean, Mick's getting old, you know? And I don't mean that to be like he can't be on a podcast, but I think he is like actively making choices. He's ended his own podcast.
Oh, you know, that's true.
We have outlasted Mick Garris's podcast here on Just King Things. And he ended it, and I think it was because he just wants to have more time to himself and to pursue, you know, his own creative endeavors.
Mm-hmm.
I think he's essentially retired from filmmaking. I don't know if that's 100% true, but I don't know of a Mick Garris project in the works currently.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he's still writing, though, because, you know, he's a short storyist, novelist. You know, I think he is writing. So I think he's just enjoying his retirement, and I think he is dialing back his obligations other than personal appearances, because, you know, there has been a run of the 20th anniversaries and 25th anniversaries of a bunch of these Stephen King things from the 90s. And so he's been showing up to those and going and doing those. You know, we had some people in the Discord talk about that they went and saw The Stand.
Mm-hmm.
Apparently, maybe someone, I can't remember if they said they mentioned us or not, but someone like purposely went up to Mick Garris to talk about them. And that person should have said that Mick Garris should be on our podcast, but they didn't. But yeah, so I think maybe the window is closed in that way. And once again, I think we are... I think we were being actively intercepted to prevent Mick Garris from knowing about us. So,
yeah.
And that's okay. I don't really care one way or the other, but due to corporate sabotage at the highest level, in telecom corporations and otherwise, I don't believe Mick Garris will ever be on the show. But if he said he would, and his only requirement was that Steve comes with him, hard no from us.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to talk to Stephen King. And people keep asking me about it. Like, I've had people in real life say, are you interested in listening, you know, in talking to Stephen King? You know, if you had the opportunity, would you do it? No, I wouldn't. I'd go to a baseball game with Stephen King. You know?
And look at him through binoculars from the other side of the stadium?
No, I'd like to sit with him. I have a hot dog. I mean, I probably wouldn't be able to eat a hot dog, but, you know, a metaphorical hot dog.
Mm-hmm.
I'd sit quietly and read a book with him. I have a feeling he'd talk the whole time.
Yeah.
But yeah, I don't need it to be recorded. But yeah, I would have I'll say it here. I'll have a social event with Stephen King if we can talk about something that's not work.
Yeah. Actually, I agree on that point. I would be fine with like being at an event and Stephen King is also there, but like I don't really have a strong interest in like recording a podcast with him.
Mm-hmm. Well, there you go. There's the answer. Do we have another question, or we're only answering one?
Oh, we have a couple. Let me decide which one. So this one is about a book we haven't read yet, so I won't bother touching on that. What is this? No, that one. Not that one. Oh, this one will be fun. Maria writes in and talks about having recently purchased an electric vehicle and wondered what we thought of what are our ideas for a Christine reboot, right? A modern day Christine that makes use of the electric vehicle developments.
That's great.
Right.
That's a good question. Who was the person who asked this question?
Maria is the name. Mm-hmm.
Didn't hear it. Great, yeah. great question, Maria.
Yeah. So I think this is some ideas that are being pitched mm-hmm. here. I think the main difference would be the car's capacity for stealth kills, which is
yeah,
true.
Of course. Yeah.
There would be room to play with suspense and feelings of dread, since the victims would be able to hear it coming. another fun topic to explore would be the nerdy teen main character and his gradual corruption into a tech bro incel. I think the other fascinating thing about this, now that I'm like sort of searching out like the parameters of the concept,
are we out of the email now?
Yes. This is
Michael Lutz talking. Okay. I'll just check.
This is me. We would have to set this movie 20 or 30 years forward in the future for it to be a vintage electric vehicle. And then we would have to come up with a way for an electric vehicle to not be totally worthless once it's used, which is kind of a problem with them now.
No. I don't think we would have to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Let me hit you with it. Okay. You ready?
Okay.
They're already a tech bro.
Okay.
So we begin from the position of technology advocate.
Okay.
They're a tech evangelist at Carco, you know, whatever.
Okay.
At Einstein.
Okay.
You know, the car company. They fall in love. You know, it's the Christine, I fell in love with a car.
Right? Uh-huh. Uh-huh. So it's not a high school student, or is it a high school student who's interning?
I think they're a college student.
Okay, college student. We're aging them up.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So just a couple years ahead. And everyone in that movie was played by a 30-year-old man anyway. So it's mm-hmm. fine. You fall in love with it. But what the company does is they're eco-conscious.
Okay.
Right? So this is the turn on it, right? They're not just a tech company. They believe that the cars of the future are the cars of the past. They do converters.
Oh, okay.
They convert. So we resurrect a Christine-like classic car. And really, to age it up appropriately, it should mm-hmm. be a car from 1997.
Yes.
or even a little bit it's a Nissan Skyline, right?
Mm-hmm.
Fast and the Furious 1, Nissan Skyline. So they convert it. And that's how you get your the first blood that goes into Christine the car, right? Comes from a conversion.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Someone gets hurt. So you can have the stealth kills, you can have all that. But here's the turn that's fun. So they remove all of that stuff that makes noise.
Mm-hmm.
I have a coworker who has recently purchased an electric vehicle, not a evil rich man's one, but a Ford or something, right?
Mm-hmm.
It has a button that makes the vroom vroom noises. Do you know about this?
I've heard about them, I think.
Right. So it's totally silent unless mm-hmm. you turn on the vroom vroom button mm-hmm. in which it makes powerful car noises.
Mm-hmm.
The Christine turn would be it's silent for the first two kills, right? And that's how it works. The first one looks like an accident. Second kill, we know the car is moving around. Christine 2, we know it's moving around, hitting people, things like that.
Mm-hmm.
Third kill, into the fourth and fifth, the fifth kill being the final, it's the end of the film. It's the big mm-hmm. final set piece. But three, it kills a random person. Four, it kills a main character. With that third one, it's making the classic Christine, the vrooms. Mm-hmm. Where do they come from? Where do the vrooms come from? We don't know.
Mm-hmm.
It's eating the classic car material. You know what I mean? It's turning the new battery stuff into the classic car. So that's what how that would be cool.
Like at a certain point, they pop open the hood and they realize the engine is converting back to gas.
Yes. Yes. the battery life's going down and they can't figure out why. And they're like, this doesn't go in here.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Because it's kind of the inverse of the show me,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Mm-hmm.
Like
mm-hmm.
Instead of going from beat up to brand new, it goes from electric to gas powered. American muscle, you know?
That's right. Oh, that's pretty good.
Yeah, look, we can do this shit in our fucking sleep, y'all. Jesus Christ, give me $8 million. I'll shoot the whole thing for $8 million.
Oh, my God. And it's easy. Oh, it's so funny because then we can have the cop can just be well, of course the car is driving around on its own. It's got an auto start.
Yes, exactly.
Right?
So there's all this ambiguity about what is the proper operations of the car versus what is the Christinisms, right? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And it's that ambiguity. And the ambiguity is only resolved in the end when it is undeniable that it has turned into a 1997 Nissan Skyline powered by gas. there's not even a battery in here anymore. And we find out because like the mechanic comes out, or like third to, you know, our C character comes out and he says, Josh, oh my God, it's like we put so much fucking money in this thing already. And you just turned it back into its old version? You took the battery out? The battery cost $15,000. Josh says, I don't know what you're talking about. Greg? No, it would really be like Taylor.
Ziegler? Oh, okay. Maddie? Ziegler? Dax?
Yeah, that's good too.
Uh-huh.
Dax is good. But yeah, that would be how, sorry to give you the full pitch, but that would be that's my pitch.
No, I think that's good. I like that.
Look, just someone give us some money. I'll write one of these things. I think I could probably knock it. You give me 6 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
I can knock out, I think, a pretty solid adaptation of any existing Stephen King thing adapted to the modern world. Based on first principles, I think I understand Stephen King at a fundamental level now, you know?
Mm-hmm. You know him, like, intellectually, the way that angels in John Milton's Paradise Lost don't have to actually talk to each other because they just intuitively know all things.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's mm-hmm. exactly it.
Yep, okay.
I have kind of sympathetic telekinesis with the Stephen King, the works of Stephen King in publication order.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I probably can't adapt anything we haven't read yet. That's probably going to be hard.
Yeah.
Because he's always shifting and moving underneath. He's wiggly like a snake, you know?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But in terms of what we've had so far, I think I could do it. I'll adapt to anything.
Yeah.
And if you like want to shoot in 2026, I'll invent some shit that doesn't exist yet. I'll make a call about the future.
Like a non-existent Stephen King book?
No, but like what could happen in 2 years that we might need to kind of preempt in order to make our up-to-date Stephen King adaptation really up-to-date?
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Pet Sematary, it's about climate change. Boom. Easy.
The deadfall is so much bigger now because all the trees are gone.
Yeah. No, even bigger than that, you don't need the old guy across the street. The old guy across the street can become not the guy that shows it to you and then is mad you found out about it. You can make him just the guy who's mad about it by having the deadfall and everything about the Pet Sematary be discovered because the trees are dying.
Mm-hmm.
The pathway becomes more clear.
Ooh.
It linearizes everything. And guess what? The swamp's drying up.
Ooh,
maybe
yeah.
The Pet Sematary is a little mad about that.
Mm-hmm.
You know? Mm-hmm. Boom! That's just off the dome, y'all. Anyway, hire us.
Yep.
Michael's a respected author.
That's right. I get nothing.
And I'm just I'm a person, but listen to the ideas, you know? I'm the ultimate idea guy. What are we doing next time, Michael?
Next month on the mainline episode, we'll be reading Dark Tower 5, Wolves of the Kala. And as we have hoped to do many, many times before for these bonus episodes, hopefully this time we will do the Dark Tower film from whatever year that was.
Oh, 2015?
Something like that. Yeah.
Oh, no. That's a good question.
Let me double check because it was 2017.
Wow.
Wait, this is weird. So when did this come out? Hold on. I'll save the main story for, wow, that was a quick turnaround. I'll save the full story for the actual show, but like one of the most extensive discussions of this movie that I have heard, because I have not seen it, but like one of the first extensive discussions that I heard about it was from the man who DJ'd my wedding. Who in our like initial like meeting with him to like, you mm-hmm. know, be like, hey, will you DJ our wedding? Somehow got on to the fact that I liked Stephen King and then just talked to me about this movie because he was so upset with it.
Now, this was like during the preview meeting, like we're gonna meet each other, or was this on stage at the wedding?
This was the preview meeting. And the reason I double checked is because I got married in 2017, which is the year that this movie came out. So this was
so
like,
he just like had it on his mind.
Yes. Okay. It was like fresh for him. Like he was like, I have been waiting for someone who knows about the Dark Tower so I can tell them how pissed off I am about this movie.
That is very funny.
Actually, that's the whole story. There you go. Like, but it was... It was because I had basically ignored it. I had not really been interested in it. And so this was like the first long discussion that I had with anyone about this movie.
Huh. That you, again, have not seen.
That I have not seen.
Well, I have. And we'll talk about that. Hopefully we'll have a guest. I just sent a message while you were telling that story. I sent a message to the person we hope to have as a guest. So... we'll hear back very soon.
Mm-hmm.
Hopefully. If we don't have a guest, that's fine. You want to hear something fun?
Sure.
You know who Matthew Holness is?
Oh, that name sounds familiar.
Some sort of dark place, perhaps?
Oh, yeah. Okay.
He just posted a screenshot on Twitter.
Uh-huh.
I was going through my tab, sending this message. And, it's a screen cap of Labyrinth zooming into her bedroom in Labyrinth.
Uh huh.
She's got a Judge Dredd book.
Okay. Wait, link this to me. I wonder what Judge Dredd book is she reading? Why didn't
it's like a collected volume? It's like on the show. You have to like really zoom in. You got to do a little, it's shown, I guess, in two shots. The first one is just kind of vague. And the second one is clearly Judge Dredd.
Oh, that is so fascinating. So of all the little, like, yes. So all the little things around her room that show up in Labyrinth World eventually.
Yep.
Why didn't Judge Dredd show up?
He is the law. We should do Judge Dredd on Shelf by Genre.
Yeah.
I think it'd be fun.
I think that could
you
be
like
fun.
Judge Dredd?
Yeah. I mean, I have kind of neutral to positive opinions about sort of that, like, a strata of 80s, 90s dystopian kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. You know, your RoboCops.
2000 AD core.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yep. Mm-hmm. Well, okay. We'll be back next month with The Dark Tower starring, Matthew McConaughey, Idris Elba.
Yep. Those are people.
Others,
that are in that
a
film.
Kid, some sort of kid,
some kid, presumably. Yes.
You haven't seen it.
I haven't. No.
You haven't seen Matthew McConaughey's fingers.
Not in this context,
buddy. I'm so excited. I think the minute you start the film and you start seeing Matthew McConaughey's fingers and what they're up to. And it's not like in the film, you know, it's not like Matt Frewer's fingers.
Uh-huh.
It's not doing that stuff. But I think I'll get a message from you as soon as you see it.
Okay.
I think it's that shocking.
Okay. All right. I'm looking forward to that.
To the point where my very brave wife continues to make fun of it today. A movie that we saw nearly 10 years ago.
My DJ did not mention Matthew McConaughey's fingers at all, so this is something about which I've remained unspoiled.
It seems to be the only important thing about the movie to me. So it's going to be interesting for you to find out. Okay. All right, we'll be back in 1 month with The Dark Tower. Thanks so much for backing us here on Patreon, patreon.com/rangetouch. Jordo, of course, edits these episodes for us for the Just Keep Things bonusodes. And thanks to Jordo for doing that.
You are welcome.
And there's no theme song, so I don't have any credit there. Michael, why don't we do this again?
Oh. Is it because we're bored? Oh, wait. No. It's we do it for Steve.